This is the Gary V Audio Experience.
Hey, podcast. Joe from Team Gary here. Today's episode is episode number 25 of Coffee and Commerce. In this episode, Gary and Zubin are joined by Warren Kornblum, the former CMO of Toys R Us. They discuss the consumer experience and how it's evolved over the years in retail. Enjoy.
It's all you, Zubin. Say hello.
Let's do it. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 25 of Coffee and Commerce with Gary Vaynerchuk, myself. And today we're joined by Warren Kornblum, the CEO of Shadow Branding Group. Thanks for joining us, Warren.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. I don't know why it took you 25 episodes to get to me.
Warren, why don't you create some context for everybody who's tuning in? Give them a little 2-3 minute, one and a half minutes of who you are.
Sure. Started out as an advertising guy, originally from Canada. Built my agency up over a decade or so. From Toronto, we expanded to Toronto and London, and then eventually to South Florida, and then sold to a company that was then called Bozell Jacobs Kenyon and Eckerd, which is now part of the Interpublic Group. Worked there for a 3-year earnout and hated the job I had because I went from being the guy who was in the meetings to the guy who was doing accounting and all that kind of stuff, and trapped in a corner office. And then was recruited when I left after my earnout. I was recruited by the then Fortune 100 Toys R Us when it was a public company. And I was at Toys R Us for the last 5 years from when it was publicly held until it went to private equity. Left when that transaction took place. And then through a whole other circuitous route, also wound up at Rooms to Go as a strategist and chief marketing officer. And then at Serta Simmons Bedding. And today what I'm doing is board work and advising companies, both legacy brands as well as startups. So legacy brands on how to defend and startups on how to attack. It's kind of a really cool perspective to have.
Yeah, I actually live a little bit of that life as well. And I think it is, I think it is a fun way. You get to see kind of both sides of the equation, which gives you clarity, which allows you to kind of help. Zubin, take us away.
Warren, really appreciate the background. So there's a lot. There's a lot for us to discuss. We had to wait 25 episodes to get you on, so we want to cram everything as quickly as we can. Let's talk about Toys R Us. Talk about your time at Toys R Us, and with the theme, like what we're talking about today, and in some of the speaking work that you're doing, your overarching theme is you're never too big to fail or too small to disrupt, and the juxtaposition of those things I think is brilliant. I'd like that to be kind of the theme behind most of our discussion today, as it I'm sure it will be. But if you could just talk to us about one side of that, Toys R Us. Not necessarily where it went wrong, but what you saw, what you observed, where the it could have gone in a different direction, and what you feel about your time at Toys R Us.
And Warren, one thing that I want you to touch on, because I know this is a short kind of like blast of time with you. For the there's a lot of entrepreneurs, I'm reading the comments. Hello, everybody on all the social platforms that are watching. Explain this notion of being, you know, you having your own business and then being part of something like Toys R Us. You know, when I hear your origin story, you were playing the long game, so you were making long decisions.
Yep.
Then you get into this environment where you have to make short decisions. I'd love to tap into your brain on something that you wanted to do in your soul. Right, Warren, that you knew because you knew how to do things, you did it before, but you couldn't do because of the construct of the game you were playing at Toys R Us. And I think that will teach people why big companies do certain things that don't make sense or may help somebody make a decision today that may come out to a different kind of outcome.
Sure, and I think that's a really great perspective. The I guess that, you know, if I look at the frustration, you know, I was actually the first time that they had brought in a quote chief marketing officer. And it was also the first time I had ever been a client in my life because I had always been on the service side. And I think, you know, I remember a couple of really quick ones. One is I remember the first day that I was on the executive committee at Toys R Us. And I remember walking into the boardroom for the first time. And I, you know, I'm a marketing guy like we all are. And I said, okay, so it's not rocket science. My customer, my target is mom with kids. I mean, you know, and she was really a second generation Toys R Us kid. So the assumption was that everything about Toys R Us, forget about reality, perception was, what a cool store. It's where I get toys. It's where I, you know, I grew up. And I remember walking into that boardroom and I said, okay, so my target's mom with kids, and the entire room was filled with guys with ties. And I said to myself, okay, well, this is a bit of a problem. And you know, we all know as great marketing people, what you have to do is you have to get out of your own skin and get into the skin of the person you're trying to talk to or the people you're trying to talk to. I think that the biggest frustration I had, Gary, was that Toys R Us became all about logistics and cost reductions. And, you know, I mean, when you talk about the magic of being a toy store and taking advantage of all the things wonderful about childhood and parents who want to get the perfect gift. I mean, everybody at Christmas time or a birthday wants to be the one who gives that kid the coolest gift, the one that they just bought. And, you know, I think that's what Toys R Us would be. The thing I really loved about my time there was the opportunity to be a part of the team that built the Times Square store.
That was cool.
Toys R Us should have been about not the fact that it was, you know, 100,000 square feet, but that it was about just in, you could just see when kids went in there, they were captivated by it.
The experience.
Yeah, 100%. So I think Toys R Us lost sight of its consumer, and it became about running this big,
It was a P&L game. I think that's right.
Big 100%.
Big shout out to Jennifer Burgess, who worked at Toys R Us in 1989. Danielle Pollock, not getting answers. She's bouncing out. I'm sorry, we're not doing Q&A. I apologize, but we're gonna continue to jam with Warren. Zubin?
Warren, you bring up the experience, and to shift gears for a moment, I think everything we've been hearing about retail, anybody that talks about retail at all, talks about how retail needs to shift into an experience and not a transaction, because we get enough transaction online. That Times Square store and certain stores around the world, the M&M store in Leicester Square, this, that, the other, right there, experiences. You did it then. There are a lot of, to Gary's point, there are a lot of folks that are following us that are entrepreneurs or in D2C, and they want to aspire to do something in retail. What are your thoughts around that experience in retail? And what does the future experience of retail in your mind look like?
I think the first thing is, and it's been mentioned, I think Gary said it a couple of times, it's not about the transaction. The transaction is something that happens if you do it right at the end of the day. But I think that really, to me, a successful entrepreneur out there, be it D2C or be it in physical space, or be it what I think is going to be the evolution is in both, is going to be able to really create the environment that their consumer that they've targeted their entire business for is going to say, wow, the biggest gift any of us can give as consumers is time. Time is precious. 100%. Time is something that we, you know, we value. And from the time I walk into that store, my time has to be honored. I'm a big believer in something I call share of heart. You know, we all talk about it's important for people to think of us, to think of us first, to give us money and all that. But you know what? When you get them to actually like you, then you win.
Warren, do you think that during your era there, do you think that you and the rest of leadership underestimated the internet from a getting them to care and doing brand building down there and thought of it more in a transactional manner, if at all? And I think it's important. I like talk about what I passed on Uber twice or many other things. I think you build so much on kind of like, I think you could teach a lot of people and they're loving you in the comments. So I like the way you're communicating. You know, I think about those years. Toys R Us is one of my favorite brands of all time.
Me too.
So I'm a Jersey kid, you know, like even when Lionel Kitty City was coming up in the 80s, I was like mad at the Kangaroo. I'm like, no, Jeffrey's my guy. You know, like, you know, that was when my family made it. Like being able to buy something at Toys R Us was like a 7-year journey for me until like we could afford it instead of like some sort of cut, you know? And so I'm just very curious. Like I feel like a lot of people, I'd love to actually leave it at that question. Going back, your organization's relationship with the internet, underestimated it, misunderstood it, mistreated it, afterthought, help me.
Missed the boat entirely would be the answer I would give you. One of the reasons that I actually was recruited to go to Toys R Us was, and you'll probably remember, a lot of the younger audience won't, but you know, there was this first wave of e-commerce that took place around 2000.
I remember Toys R Us doing the deal with Amazon.
Well, yeah, and also E-Toys. There was a brand called E-Toys that had, was a year old, had I think $50 million in total revenues. Toys R Us, 50 years old, so a year, 50, 12 billion versus 50 million. And eToys had a market cap greater than Toys R Us. I think there was a lot of bad math in those days, but our e-commerce was awful. And I'll tell you, Gary, I was asked to consider coming back into Toys R Us in the next generation of it. And to me, I said that the biggest thing is you almost have to, you know, physical stores have to almost be second to getting a really magical Disney-ish website going. And I just think, I think it was absolute, aside from carrying too much debt load, it was the absolute death knell of Toys R Us, was never, ever, ever figuring out e-commerce. And and not even so much, e-commerce is a bad way to put it. It was bringing the brand to life online and really creating an amazing place
I think the thing that you said, and I want to get this in because so many entrepreneurs listen to this show, Zubin, that are early, and I'm always trying to make that connective tissue to them because they can't necessarily relate to the level that Warren played at, or it's a different place. What Warren's saying to a lot of you, and I could tell by the way he's saying it, him and I are brothers, and I'm excited to build our relationship offline, is at some point Toys R Us became how much money will we make this year obsessed, not what the heck is going on with the customer, what do they want? And the second that transformation happened, it was game fucking over. A lot of you right now are in year two of making $800,000 from making $30,000 in year one, and you're thinking about the house and the boat and the Rolex that you're gonna buy instead of feeding your business. The small company version of what Warren and I are, and Zubin are talking about right now is taking too much money off the table to buy a BMW instead of pouring it back into your business. I built my dad's business very aggressively because I didn't take any money off the table. I was pouring it back into the machine, which allowed for bigger economics later for my dad. You see that connection, Warren? Do you agree? You've
started a company. No, 100%. And I also think that in those days, as even as a public company, and I think it can translate down to early stage entrepreneurs too. In the public world, you found out, and companies still do it today, that they manage their business for 2 months the way they think they should manage their business. And the third month of the quarter is getting ready for the analyst call. And you do stuff that just makes no sense whatsoever.
You're appeasing Wall Street right. to make it look like you're doing something they want, that you think they want.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, that's completely against what the consumer wants.
Exactly. And they were basically voting with their dollars. And, I think to your point, Gary, even on, the young entrepreneur in their first or second year, and you're right about not buying, it's not about so much buying thing, but even as you're looking to what do I do with this business, you're absolutely right. It's invest in the business, and most importantly, invest in the business's ability to relate to their customers.
I want to touch on something you mentioned there. Bit of a tangent, but I think it's really important for the audience, especially those, which is basically everybody here, that follows Gary. Oftentimes people are wondering, like, what is Gary like in a boardroom? What is Gary like in these meetings? And you hit on a really important point, because this is a constant conversation that we have, which is, okay, we've got this target to hit, that target to hit, et cetera, this quarter. I think the critical thing here, and this is an aspirational thing for everyone that's listening, is we'll go in, somebody will say something. Most people, 99.9% of people, will within that paradigm go, okay, this is a problem that I have to now solve. How do I solve this problem? The difference between that and Gary is Gary will be like, okay, how do I flip this on its head? How do I figure out how to change that problem completely so that we can get the result we want? So that influence, I think, is really important. And to understand that you can look at problems now, again, most of us don't have that leverage, don't have that ability. But to be able to think that way and understand that ultimately there are reasons, and they could be illogical reasons, why a lot of these decisions are made, but to have the ability to push back and get to that point where you're able to course correct without having to stay within the confines of the problem is really interesting.
Well, in today's world, safe sucks. It just does. I mean,
it's dangerous.
Play it down the middle, you're going to get hit with the ball at some
point. Safe is no longer safe.
It's not, because the reality is that the consumer's options and the speed of innovation make it a vulnerability.
Absolutely, 100%.
I mean, look, again, because I think we're doing a lot of relating to a lot of the audience that's watching. When influencers didn't, what's going on Instagram right now is organic reach is really getting affected. Yes. And so 2 years ago when I'm like, go on TikTok, they're like, I'm crushing over here. My ego doesn't allow me to start at zero again. They thought they were playing it safe. Now they're in trouble. You just see it everywhere.
Yeah. And I think sometimes you also, you overdo it, right? You play the hand too much. And at some point when you do that, you start, you know, with those examples, at some point you start to almost become redundant. And then people, and when you get into that trend thing on information and influencers, if there's not the credibility, then people will stop listening. Right. And, you know, so,
the other thing that happens, and I see this in the music industry and Hollywood and in advertising, one of the things I would argue the single biggest reason that I am Gary V is because I still want my ear to the ground of my craft. Warren, I compete against executives in Adland, as you know better than most, that aren't actual content producers, aren't actually running ads, aren't actually looking for business results. I am meta to what I do. I'm a practitioner of my craft more than the people that even work for me, the most progressive company.
Yeah.
I think that people lose their ear to the ground. You know, what got them there is, I say this to a lot of people, and it's been really hitting for some of my friends. I'm like, Gary, I'm like, my friend, what got you here is the thing that will get you to the next place. And you were convinced by somebody, not yourself, that it was something else. Right. I'm tripling down on what got me here. I'm getting more dirty, more in the trenches, more engaging, more content, this kind of content, that kind of content. Like I'm tripling down on the dirt, and people are so quick to enjoy the fruits of the penthouse, they lose their sensibility, flavor, taste, strategy, context, and ability in the fucking game, Warren.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You know, it's sort of, Gary, almost, I 100% agree with you. And it's almost like going back to your original question about what frustrated me the most about Toys R Us, because Toys R Us lost its way, forgot who it was, forgot why it was there. You know, it wasn't about cubic feet of warehouse and all that shit. It was about getting, you know, being the biggest selection of, and making kids happy and making parents and uncles and aunts and friends feel really cool for having been able to do it. So it was about satisfying customer need and understanding it. And it was not about what it became. Yeah. You're absolutely right. It completely lost sight of the magic of being Toys R Us, what you and I remember as kids.
100%.
You know?
Don't count me out, even though I was in the clearance aisle the whole time. I was there as well.
Dollar's a dollar, buddy.
The brand association, the feeling, the emotion behind that, I think all of us can, certainly relate to. Let's talk about customers for a moment and lean in there. You mentioned you're never too big to fail or too small to disrupt, right? But if you're not too small to disrupt, what is at the core of failure or disruption? And how do those folks listening in, and frankly, any company, because again, you're probably not too big to disrupt either, but what is it? How do you disrupt?
I think what you do is, first of all, it 100% starts with the consumer in the middle of it. And understanding it's not all consumers aren't created equal, for sure. Okay. So based on what it is that you do and who it is that's going to buy what you do or be loyal to you in what you do, having a really acute understanding of them and getting, as I said earlier, getting out of your own skin and getting into their skin. The assumption is that, you know, it's funny, as you know, later in my career, I spent a lot of time in the mattress business. And, you know, the never too big to fail is also a great example there. I mean, here you got all these legacy brands, some of which I was helping, and Serta and Simmons, and, you know, you got a lot of other ones. And 8 years-ish ago, you know, there's a bunch of people who take credit for being first. Casper obviously was raised the most money for sure and spent the most money on advertising. But, you know, Casper, Purple, Tough the Needle, Lisa, they all came out around the same time. What was their key to disrupting? Their key to disrupting was, one, they realized that people just didn't like shopping for mattresses. They didn't like shopping for mattresses.
I would literally rather Zubin punch me in the neck with a hot iron than go buy a mattress.
It wasn't enough to just punch you, it had to be a hot iron as well.
Hot iron.
Well, and you know, what didn't you like? You didn't like the fact that you felt like you were going into almost like they used to use the used car analogy.
I like my time, Warren.
Right.
Like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, jump on this thing and they all feel fucking fine.
Yeah, well, but you know, then there's the other side of it, which is that, you know, the brilliance of these guys was they realized the shopping experience sucked, so let's eliminate the shopping experience. They realize time is a value, so let's try and make it as simple as we can. they realized that people had no idea about what the value prop in mattresses was. And there, I think that the industry, the legacy people in the industry, including me, did an awful job of communicating what's the difference between a $3,000 Tempur-Pedic and a $999 Casper. There is a difference. I promise you there's a difference. But it got obfuscated. It just got thrown out because the marketing was so spot on by the disruptors. So Zabine, to answer your question, I think it's a real keen focus on the people you're trying to do and give them a solution that's respectful of them. Not that you're trying to shove at them, but that they sit there and go, you know what? Great, I can get it tomorrow. If I don't like it, I can send it back and I don't have to spend a lot of money on it. And I'm not gonna have some salesperson tackling me in the store, not letting me out the door until I buy something.
Two thoughts. One, absolutely, as it relates to the consumer, and it might just be one thought, by the way, as I'm thinking through it.
One thought that's so good that it pulls
one thought that's so good.
As long as he doesn't throw the hot iron at me, I'm fine. So.
There's two thoughts that's one that's so good it won't even come out. Here's a question. Going all the way back to what we mentioned about Toys R Us, because I think that's critical. You've got a bunch of men in a room making decisions for their customer that are moms buying for their kids, right? Then, on the other hand, you have Gary Vee, who is chairman and CEO of VaynerX, and you go to any other ad agency, you look at their chairman and CEO, they're not involved, A, and B, they're not setting trends, they're just trying to follow and be an influencer, right? He's setting culture. So the question really is both for you, Warren, and for you, Gary. In your case, Warren, when you look at that boardroom, how do you create more diversity in the boardroom to better reflect the customers? And then Gary, how are you not only looking at like being able to comment on the direction the world is going in, but actually deliberately setting culture? You're creating culture.
You know, Zubin, I'll jump in first. So I apologize, Warren. I really don't think I set culture. I swear to God, I was listening. I couldn't wait to jump in. I don't think so. Here's a good one. Whatever I'm going to ask you right now, so I'll give you a second to give a good answer. What I set, and then I'll give you the answer of why that's not true. So go ahead. What culture have I set?
You've set the culture that's making entrepreneurship exciting, something to aspire to, something that is as aspirational as becoming a basketball player.
Let's talk about it.
Okay.
So there, you know, Kevin Rose, you know, the MySpace guys, Tom, you know, Sarah Blakely, there was people doing entrepreneurship on top of Web 2.0. And so what I was seeing was, oh, the internet's about to mature so I can put out content around my entrepreneurship. But the bubble was already happening, right? Entrepreneurship was booming, you know, in that early, you know, from 95 to 2005, the internet created a macro structure where entrepreneurship became practical in a way that it wasn't for Warren and I prior to that. I might have been funny in that I had a personality that was so comfortable in one skin that I was one of the people amongst others that, you know, captured people's attention in the communication of it. But to me, I think it's because I rode what was happening early, and had I not existed, because this is how I think about setting culture. If I didn't exist, would it exist? And I don't think I've ever done anything that would it exist if I hadn't been there. I think I incorporate into culture and consumer behavior at a speed and an observation that is stronger than most on earth. But I don't think I said it because I don't think I do anything that creates something that wouldn't have been there without me.
I think the 70-year-old man in the comments, the 12-year-old girl, the 18-year-old college student, the 34-year-old single mom, the 45-year-old pastor would beg to disagree with you.
Well, I'm going to read comments while Warren jumps in.
I think the first thing is I think culture is such a tough concept. Not because it's not something I don't believe in, but you know, when you ask people what culture means, even just listening to the conversation, it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And I think from my perspective, when you ask about that boardroom and what could have been done differently, first of all, you mentioned the word diversity, 1,000%. But I think it's also, you know, I've always said to myself when I had my own agencies, it was like, I want to fill the room with really smart people. And I kind of hope I'm not the smartest one in the room. Hopefully I'm the one who can, when the right idea happens, I can just jump on it, but it doesn't have to come from me. And I think when you talk about, you know, so what is that? That's a culture of creativity and empowerment and stuff like that. Right. I think there's cultures that are, you know, we're going to be passionate about our customers. That's a culture, you know, I think culture, that's why culture I don't think it's a universal concept that always means the same thing. I think in the right environment, but what leadership does, which is probably where you're talking, Zubin, about Garen, yes, is he sets the vision, is passionate about it, takes no hostages, and is prepared to do it himself and fall on the sword for it. But he, you know, it's clear, it's concise, and you know what it is.
Absolutely. And the point that I'm perhaps trying to make here, as I'm trying to figure this out, is it's not just that he's prepared to, it's that he does. He enjoys it. He loves it. And he loves being part of that process.
100%.
And then look at that point from the poor investor.
You know what's crazy about that? And as you just said, and I'm reading the comments, I appreciate the kind words and the observations. It's crazy what you just said. Do you know what I said in my head as you delivered that sentence? Humility. The amount of people that look at me and don't see humility is almost everybody, except I see Henry. You know, like I think it's getting a little more obvious. I think my wordsmithing has changed. But I've always known that humility was my superpower. I'm an aggressive communicator. I have conviction. Conviction's incredibly easy to balance with humility. It's just unique. It's just unique. And then you add a little Jersey street and a little immigrant underdog, and you get a formula. But I think humility is incredibly underrated. Warren, I noticed you reacted to that when I dropped that.
100%. I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, what humility does is, I think humility entices people to listen to you, right? Versus the other way, when you're, you know, people just start to turn that off. And I think humility also allows you to listen to other people. It allows you to not think you have all the answers. And I think that it's an absolutely vital piece of any successful, you know, entrepreneur is you know, you can be aggressive and you can be fairly, you know, confident in your opinions, but if you don't have the humility to realize that it's not only about you, I think at some point you hit the wall.
100%. You're dead. If you're a leader that doesn't understand that you work for them, not the reverse. I mean, Zubin has been very kind on this episode. Thank you, Zubin. But in private meetings with me, it's been one of my most delicious relationships in the last 2 years, based on something very interesting, which was he had his own company. I bought his company, and he had a lot of reservations and concerns that it would be good. And for me to exceed his greatest optimism is why he communicates to me the way he does behind closed doors. And it means the world to me. It's fucking flattering.
100%.
But that's because I think I work for him, Warren. I bought his company, I gave him money, and I feel like I work for him.
Well, in some respects you do. And if we don't feel that way, then, you know, you lose sight of what you're doing. If you didn't feel that way, you know, people always say to me, so what's your biggest fear? And I always say my biggest fear is fear of failure. And it's not because I'm afraid of failing. It's afraid of letting people down. It's afraid of not having my game on. It's afraid of, you know, when someone calls me into a room to advise, be it a startup or a big company, it's not feeling like I accomplished something on their behalf or gave them, you know, it sounds trite, but gave them added value that when I leave the room, it was a better meeting than when I walked in. You know, that's, I put it as fear of failure. Maybe it's not fear of failure, but it's
no, you know, that's what, how you define failure. And I think that for those of you that are listening, like, oh, I'm in a job or I'm doing this, this is the right place for me, whatnot. I can tell you, it's definitely not the right place for you. If you are not rooting for your partner, your coworker, your boss to be successful.
Nothing like a great team. Nothing like a great
team. You really care passionately about their success.
Even in like pickup basketball. Yeah. Like Warren, you just said nothing like a great team. I literally thought about a single pickup game in 1998 as you just said that. Like there's like random peeps and you just gel and there's just nothing I always go to that place, and always, I occasionally go to the place of this single pickup game where the five of us should have never run that playground that day. We shouldn't have won a single game, let alone six. But, and that's why I'm always believing team. I'm like, these are five, I think maybe two of my friends were there, and it was two. But punchline, five players that had never played together, most connections, didn't even really know each other. And sometimes it just happens, and it makes me believe in team the most.
100%. And you know, I'll bet you, Gary, if you ran into and you remembered any of, you know, the other three, the non-two friends, you'd probably have a connection as last for two decades, right? We were there, we did that. That was cool. Yeah.
I right now want to give a huge shout out to Keyshawn and Kenny. I don't recall their last names, but in third grade, we had a baseball team and we were kind of the diamond, the three.
Yeah.
And like, I feel feelings towards them right now, Warren, that you can't imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Third grade baseball.
Share a heart. I'm telling you, they got a piece of you.
100%.
Yeah.
Share of heart. Love it.
This is fun. Take us away, Zubin. I got to run and do some family stuff. Warren, it's such a pleasure. Let's get connected. Zubin, maybe connect us on email. I'd love to share a meal at some point or a drink virtually or something, Warren. I really appreciate your time.
Me too. Thank you. Keep up the good work here. You know, I'm a fan too, so it's great for me to be here and get to meet you guys, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Warren, thank you so much for joining us. Audience, thank you for the comments. Thank you for engaging with us today. I hope you got a lot out of today. It was a milestone episode for us, episode 25. Looking forward to seeing you all back in a couple of weeks. Warren, thanks again. Thanks for making the time, and we'll definitely have you back on.
All right, episode's over. Please leave a review and subscribe up on Apple. It would mean a lot to me. Thank you very much.
Today's highlighted review is Everything in Its Place by the great Bambino 1234. I love how vast the footprint the Gary V sets up across the digital space, but I find myself here the most. I'm glad it pulls in from other interviews and other podcasts. Such a rising tide concept. Love it. Keep those reviews coming. We could highlight yours next.